Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to my podcast interview with Mike Ingham, former BBC football correspondent, who has recently released an audiobook version of his autobiography, After Extra Time and Penalties, Memories of the BBC Football Correspondent. From the age of seven, Mike had always had a burning ambition to work at the BBC. He got his first break working at BBC Radio Derby before joining BBC Sport Radio at Broadcasting House in London. It was a trip with his dad to the 1964 FA Cup final between Preston and West Ham, which was a life-changing moment for Mike, showing him the power of communication through commentary and how sports commentary could change people's lives. While at Wembley watching that FA Cup final, Mike noticed a Lancashire man looking up to the sky with a big smile on his face and enjoying the match through description and commentary from his sighted friend. During his life as a sports broadcaster, Mike received many letters from blind and partially sighted listeners. From his time working at BBC Radio Derby, right through to a note when he retired from the BBC in 2014 from a Right Honourable David Blunkett, thanking him for bringing football to life for him over the years. In my interview via Zoom with Mike, we chatted about his early life supporting his local football club, Plymouth Argyle, his time at both BBC Radio Derby and at BBC Sport in Broadcasting House, what it was like working with some of the great sports broadcasters, and of course, not forgetting that life-changing moment at the FA Cup final in 1964. I first began by asking Mike why he wanted to write After Extra Time and Penalties, and why it was so important for him to record an audiobook version.
Well, I wanted to write the book for a couple of reasons, really, Toby. Having been a football correspondent for nearly a quarter of a century and lived through so many changes in my sport, football, and also in broadcasting as well, I just felt I wanted to document all of that. I mean, I particularly wanted to write something for my children to pass on as well through the family. And the other really important thing I wanted to do was to pay tribute in the book to some of the radio sport pioneers who were my mentors, who just helped me enormously. And I'm talking about great commentators like Peter Jones and Brian Butler, because there's never really been that much written about them. And I thought, well, I was lucky enough to work with these people, and I just felt obliged to do it, wanted to do it. And in terms of the audiobook, well, I think that's almost kind of self-explanatory, really, because I was deeply aware during my time as a broadcaster that many of the people who were listening to me relied on me because they weren't able to see. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do a book, then it's just logical for them to be able to hear that book as well and hear my voice.
And you say in the book, from the age of seven, you always had an ambition to want to work at the BBC. Was that always in the back of your mind whilst you were going through school and university that you were desperate to get into the BBC and work there?
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure exactly the moment when I thought this is going to be the career and the pathway I want to pursue. I think in my early days as a seven-year-old, it was just more about my obsession with radio, I think. I was brainwashed by radio, really, as a child. And the reason for that was that it was always on in the home. I was born in 1950, and radio had really come into its own during the Second World War. Everybody had relied on it in the way that I think people have again over these last three or four difficult months. The only fantasy, really, that our black and white little television, we only had one channel on the television in those days. The only thing that could offer me, really, was cowboys and Indians films, you know. So that my senses were much more stirred by listening to music, listening to sport on the radio. I mean, for example, I can remember freezing January mornings when we lived in Wales, getting up and seeing my dad listening to the cricket commentary crackling through from Australia, you know, and I was sort of mesmerised by that. And I remember listening to all the children's favourites, the records, the Danny Kaye stuff, the Max Bygraves and everything else. And then a decade later, when I had my own little transistor, I'd take it off to bed with me and listen to Radio Luxembourg, and I loved hearing all the football commentaries coming from overseas. And even I was so obsessive that I used to even listen to the Test cricket on the radio and keep the score. You know, I used to keep the score listening to the Test cricket on the radio. And even now, I've only got to hear a piece of music, like say the Pick of the Pops theme or something like that, or the Hancock's half hour music, to remind me of my radio days as a youngster. So I was completely indoctrinated by radio.
Back then, did you think that you would ever get there? And did you think that those ambitions that you had as a child would ever be fulfilled, sort of looking back now?
Well, you have to be very lucky, and I was very lucky. I was the beneficiary of sort of sliding doors experiences. And I know I was fortunate in many ways to get the breaks that I got, because when I started off in local radio, which was my foundation in Derby, they were wonderful years. I'd only had a couple of years of experience commentating for the Birmingham Hospital Radio Network when I was a student in Birmingham. I helped them out with some football and cricket commentary. It was awful. I mean, I would hate to hear that stuff now, you know, but at least it gave me something to knock on the door at Radio Derby with. And 'cause I'd been rejected by quite a few radio stations up until that day. So I knew I was being fortunate when they invited me in. And it just so happened that on that day, they'd heard that one of their staff was going on an attachment for 3 months, so they had a vacancy. So they asked me if I'd like to start, and I did. And I mean, I did crucial jobs in the early days, like reclaiming the tape, you know, so it could be used again for interviews and things like that. And it took me a couple of years before I was actually given a microphone and then started broadcasting.
Going back to the first match you ever went to with your dad, I think it was Plymouth Argyle at Home Park. Can you remember that experience of being there with your dad at first time and that sort of father-son experience?
Well, it was one of the happiest days of my life. It was one of those days that you never really want to end, because I'd had this sort of slow build-up to going to see Plymouth Argyle. I used to play for the Wolf Club Cubs in the park outside where the ground was. So when we were playing our games on a Saturday afternoon, if Argyle were at home, I could hear the crowd. And there was usually about 25,000 people in the ground. So again, that sort of got my senses working overtime. And I'd been told about some of the players at school, because two of my school colleagues used to go to the matches. And so when I finally did go with him, it was an FA Cup game against Gillingham. It just, everything about it was just, I mean, looking at it as a child, the whole experience, it seemed to me in those days, was just so much more theatrical than it is now anyway, because you didn't see the teams until they ran out at 5-3. They weren't on the pitch warming up or anything like that. You had a brass band playing before the game and stood behind the goal. I had a little stool to stand on because I wasn't very tall. And there were no away fans either, because these were days before motorways. So, you know, there was no way that you were ever going to see anybody from another club at Home Park. And they were not a great side, but they gave me my foundation. And what's been wonderful for me now is that since retirement, I'm back in that area again. And I've been able to take my second son to see Argyle play, because I never had the chance to do that with my oldest boy, you know, because of my BBC commitments.
Yeah, great memories for both of you to cherish, I suspect, as well. And did you still get that sort of excitement and experience of your first match when you were going to games that you were reporting on, or was it a different experience?
Well, first of all, I think your relationship with footballers changes when you start working in the business. You become less starry-eyed. I mean, I was a Plymouth Argyle fan and then a Derby County fan when we moved, and couldn't support Plymouth anymore because we're just too far away. And so I used to idolise those players. But when I started to watch games and I was interviewing players, clearly the relationship changes, which is sad in a way, in that I did lose that. I suppose inevitably some of the games become routine, but the ones that always give you a tingle, you can never be ever complacent about going to see any England game, for example, especially in a World Cup or a European Championship. Always used to get a little tingle when the anthems were played before that game. All the big Champions League nights as well, they're nights that I really miss now. And FA Cup finals. FA Cup finals were always very special. In fact, I owe the FA Cup final everything, really, in terms of teaching me about the power of radio, about the power of communication, because my eyes were completely open the day my dad took me to see the West Ham Preston game in 1964 at Wembley. And I, you know, for me, that was my kind of road to Damascus day. And you probably know that story, do you?
Yeah, I do. This the story of you going with your dad to the 1964 FA Cup final and listening to a Lancashire man commentating on the match to his blind friend. And you say in the book he was sort of a smile on his face. He was looking up to the sky and really enjoying the match through the commentary from his friend. That's a real sort of standout moment for me in your book. And I wondered, as you say, sort of it affected your career in a way and gave you an experience that you may not have ever come across before. And how much of a changing experience was that particular moment? Because there are other changing moments in the book, but that one seems to stand out.
Well, it just demonstrated to me, really, the role of the commentator in the most amateur way, really, between these two lads. Because the one that couldn't see, and he was just looking up at the sky, and he had his Preston shirt on, and he had his big rosette and everything else, and had a lovely smile on his face, because I don't know what relation he was. He might have been his brother, he might just have been a friend, but he was describing the whole game to him. And it took me a few minutes to really work out what was going on. And then when I did realise, I was just mesmerised, really. I almost sort of started to listen to his commentary myself, you know. And I think for me, the golden rule of radio was that you're only really, or should be, commentating or communicating with one person, one listener. And I think if you believe the opposite to that, then you're kind of losing the plot, really, if you think you're talking to thousands, because it'll sound like that. And I probably had two people in mind when I was commentating. I used to think about my next door neighbour when I was growing up, who became a sort of inherited uncle, and he encouraged me to follow my dreams. And he was interested in football without being completely obsessed with it. So in that way, I hoped, if I was thinking of him, I was pitching it at the right level. But then I also never forgot that moment at Wembley and that realisation that somebody was relying on those words to be able to enjoy the game. And in fact, when I did retire, and I received a lot of nice messages when I retired, probably the one that meant the most to me was a thank you from David Blunkett, the former Home Secretary, because obviously he's a blind listener. He's a passionate Sheffield fan. You know, we must have brought him many moments of highs and lows. So in the back of my mind, I always try to think of my next door neighbour, and I always used to try and think of somebody who actually couldn't see the game. So they were needing our commentary even more.
And there are some great descriptive moments in the book when you, I think, describe one of the football pitches as a sort of sticky toffee pudding kind of pitch, and talking about Lowry sort of type skylines and stadiums and things like that. Was there always time to add in those descriptive moments compared to sort of commentating on what was happening on the pitch? Were you able to sort of give that full picture?
You had to, even amidst the hurly-burly of the game, try and make time for that light and shade. I think it's so important. I think, actually, football commentary is quite a simple procedure, really. I mean, some people do try and overcomplicate it, but obviously there's a world of difference, as everyone will appreciate, between a football commentary on the radio and on the television. And on the radio, you've got to try and make the listener feel that they're sitting next to you, ideally, at the venue, by, as you've just talked about, painting as many pictures as you can. My mentor, really, in football commentary, and your older listeners will remember Peter Jones. He was a master craftsman at this. If you ever listen to any of his commentaries, for the first 2 or 3 minutes, he would set the scene for you vividly, always in colour. He would describe the stadium, the weather, the fans, his vantage point. And then when the game started, he didn't try and describe everything that was happening in the game, because that's very difficult. It just sounds a bit of a jumble if you try and do that. So he let the game breathe. He took an overview like they do in the tennis. And he adhered to the two golden rules. And I think this is really important, Toby. The golden rules for me in radio commentary, first of all, is you've got to tell the listener where the ball is, and you've got to give the score. It sounds so simple, but you would be amazed how many people actually don't. So if you listen and you don't know where the ball is, then obviously you can't really follow the game. No. And the simple way of doing that, if I'll use an example, I mean, if Manchester United are playing in front of you, say, from left to right, and their right back is Gary Neville, if he's got the ball, you know, you say the ball is now with Gary Neville near side the right. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. It's not rocket science. And as a listener, I get infuriated if I don't know where the ball is and don't know what the score is. So geography, as well as painting those pictures you talked about, is the most important feature of any commentary. And then I think it's important also, thinking of the listener, to try and use your voice like a bit of a gearbox and not stay, you know, in one monotone level. You've got to try and move up the gears when it becomes more exciting. But then you mustn't make every game sound like the World Cup final, because then when you do finally get to the World Cup final, you've got nowhere to go. Also, a little bee in my bonnet now, as I listen to commentaries all the time, I suppose, is that I don't like commentaries being cluttered up with lots of meaningless facts and figures. I think you're there to describe the game.
And in those days that BBC Radio Derby, most local radio stations have a lot of loyal listeners who, you know, do support their local radio station. And I think you had then also lots of letters from visually impaired listeners sort of giving you possibly feedback and comments on your reporting and commentating. Can you remember any of those letters that they sent you?
Yes, I do. I can. And the letters I remember most of all from that time were, well, two lots of different kinds of letters, very different. I used to treasure the letters I used to treasure the letters I got from the forces overseas in terrible conflict situations, you know, who used to listen to the radio. I was very moved by getting letters from people in prison as well, who used to rely on the radio, and the visually impaired audience as well. They had a special programme at Radio Derby, actually, which was a duplicated with Radio Nottingham. And I used to get lovely letters, which just made it all worthwhile, you know, to receive those. And it kind of kept my feet on the ground, too.
And when you did make that move to BBC Radio Sport in Broadcasting House in London and working with some of those great broadcasters that you mentioned earlier on, you know, Cliff Morgan, Brian Butler, Peter Jones, etc., etc., what was it like taking your first steps into Broadcasting House?
Like the first day at school, really. because it was such a culture shock going from, you know, where I used to live in Derby, which is a couple of sort of traffic lights away from the radio station, and obviously it was one just big intimate happy family there, and then the commute to London every day was difficult to get used to. But then when you arrived at Broadcasting House, and I walked in on that first morning, the first Monday morning, and everyone seemed to have pre-assigned desks, two rows, and I'm looking at, you know, Desmond Lynham, Christopher Martin Jenkins, Gerald Williams, Peter Jones, you know, they were all there on that Monday morning, sort of eyeing me up and down, you know, but then things evolve, and I ended up very fortunately having relationships with all of these people, like the ones I had at Radio Derby. Again, we were one big happy family in Broadcasting House. And Brian Butler, who was my predecessor as the football correspondent, he was, I've mentioned Peter, but what Brian, again, older listeners will remember, and this is an example of things that are better on radio, I think, than on television. Brian used to orchestrate and present the FA Cup draw from Lancaster Gate in London, the FA headquarters. And he presided over this, and it became a real institution. It was the way that he did it. It was very theatrical as he set the scene. And in fact, some people used to say that when he did it, you could almost smell the cigar smoke and the dust from the volumes of books, you know, around him at Lancaster Gate seeping through the wireless. It was wonderful. And, you know, he was just a master craftsman, was Brian. And I learned so much from him. And I just think that there are certain things. I watch the draw now on the television, and it's a real dog's dinner sometimes. And some things are best left to radio. I actually also think, I don't know if you'd agree with me or not, but I think it's better listening to football results on the radio than it is. Because if you don't know the score and you're listening for that inflection at the end to see whether your team have won or lost or drawn, there's nothing beats that for drama if you don't already know the score. Yeah, although television has in many ways sort of killed the radio star, and there are certain things still, I think, that radio is still on its own at doing.
And I suppose the relationship between football and the media and radio has changed so much over the years. And, you know, football has changed so much. I think in the book you say that after the 1966 World Cup, after England winning, which, you know, hopefully England might win again someday, but you know, football changed at that time. And I don't know whether you feel we can get back to those days where there is a closer link between the player and the fan and the team and the fan as well.
I suppose a lot depends on at what level you're watching the game. I think if you're asking me whether it will change in the Premier League, sadly it won't, I'm afraid. It just won't. But it can. There's still a chance lower down the leagues. When I first started watching, I used to go watching Derby County in Derby. We used to go sometimes, my dad and I, to the railway station, because the visiting team would come in on the train. And we'd walk to the ground with the players. You know, we would literally walk to the baseball ground for half an hour from the railway station. And I can remember walking with some absolute giants of the game, Stanley Matthews, John Charles, you know, people like that, to the game. And they weren't bothered too much by autograph hunters or anything like that. They took it all in their stride. But I suppose one of the biggest changes now is that relationship between the supporter and the fans. And I don't like the idea of having these exclusive tunnel clubs now in the Premier League where you can get access to players, but only if you spend thousands and thousands of pounds to get that. I think that is sad. I mean, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to write to players for autographs, and 99% of them would reply back. And I hope that still happens nowadays. I hope it does. Again, though, another sign of the times, Toby, when you do get the autograph, but you can't read it now. If you see a player's autograph nowadays, it's just a squiggle. It's almost like, I'm too busy. Do this as quickly as possible. You know, whereas if you look at the autographs of people like Jimmy Armfield or Bobby Charlton or Bobby Moore, or Tom Finney, they're all pristinely written, you know. And also, they didn't, by the way, put their number of their shirt next to the name. They haven't got the audacity to do that. You know, they never assume that they own that shirt.
And I think you finally hung up your BBC commentator's microphone in 2016. How hard was it for you walking away from BBC Sport and broadcasting? Well, it's a broadcasting house, but it probably wasn't broadcasting house, and it was probably Salford or somewhere.
It was a gradual exit because I did my last commentary in 2014. And then they asked me for 2 years to do one or two special programmes. So that was interesting because I went back to my roots, if you like, because I'd started off before commentating as a presenter of Sport On 2. So I was interested to do that. I did half a dozen programmes for them in the end and finished in 2016. And as you say, the last programme that I ever introduced and was involved in for the BBC was the celebration of 1966, 50 years on. And the lovely thing about that programme was that one of the guests was Jimmy Armfield, who was a member of that England World Cup squad, who'd become a great friend of mine, great colleague, sadly passed away. And so that was the last time we worked together. In fact, it's probably the last time we even spoke to each other. And the lovely thing about Jimmy Armfield, it really says everything that I admire about football and the way it was then and possibly isn't now. I don't know if you remember, but Jimmy was in the World Cup squad, but only the 11 players got medals on that day who won the World Cup. And Jimmy had been a former England captain, and he was still one of the first people on the pitch at the end, on the final whistle, beaming and hugging everybody, even though he knew he wasn't going to be going up to the Royal Box to get a medal. What was important to him was England and the overall, you know, the team ethic, and that was just wonderful. And said an awful lot about him as a person.
Yeah, which you probably wouldn't get nowadays with with football players, sadly. Well, Mike, thank you so much indeed for your time today and for chatting with me. It's been fantastic. And
thank you, Toby. Thank you.
And the book is absolutely wonderful. It was a great listen. I enjoyed listening to the whole book and, you know, some fabulous moments in there. But thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking an interest in it. Thank you.
After extra time and penalties, Memories of a BBC Football Correspondent by Mike Ingham is published by Book Guild Publishing and is available as an audiobook, a Kindle download, and in other formats. To find out more about my portfolio of services, do visit my website, tobydavy.co.uk, where you'll also find out how to contact me and follow me on social media. Do all keep safe and well.